Arthur Z was born in New York City in 1950. He is a second-generation Chinese-American. He was educated at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of 8 books of poetry, including Ginkgo Light, Quipu, The Redshifting Web, and Archipelago. He is the winner of many, many, many awards, including 2 NEA Awards, the Lanham Foundation Award, the Guggenheim Fellowship. He was elected Chancellor of the American Academy of American Poets in 2012. He is Professor Emeritus of the Institute of American Indian Arts. This is what I really like about your resume, this interesting fact, the first poet laureate of Santa Fe. And how long have you lived in Santa Fe?
40 years.
From New York City to Santa Fe. How did you arrive in Santa Fe?
Well, I came to Santa Fe from California when I graduated from the University of California at Berkeley. This was back in 1972. And I had the good fortune to work with the poet and critic Josephine Miles. I asked Josephine if she had a place to recommend. I wanted to go somewhere I'd never been before. And she said, oh, you should try New Mexico. It's really beautiful. And for a poet, you can live very cheaply there.
At the time.
So, yeah, not anymore.
She gave me the names of a few friends. And so I came to Santa Fe not knowing anyone exactly 40 years ago. And I called 3 different people that Josephine had recommended. And one of them, Stanley Noyes, was the coordinator for the New Mexico Poetry in the Schools program. He said that if I decided to stay in New Mexico, I could probably work the following year as a poet in the schools. And so I decided to just stay, and one thing led to another, and that short stay has now turned into 40 years.
Wow, you are really among the Santa faithful. Can you discuss your poetry's relationship with Santa Fe?
Well, New Mexico's been a huge influence on my poetry. I think the multicultural aspects of Santa Fe have been particularly important to me. Most people stress the landscape and the light of northern New Mexico, and I would certainly agree to that. But I would also say that the braiding of cultures, and, you know, there's a kind of cliche of all the cultures living in harmony or whatever, but I actually find that the tensions between cultures are endlessly fascinating and energizing. And so very early on, I met some of the Native students who were students at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and that led to my going to the Institute and doing readings and classes, and then eventually, you know, I taught there for 22 years. So Native culture has been a really strong influence on my poetry. But again, in terms of Santa Fe, even though it's a small town, there are lots of really interesting people who live here or who pass through. So I've learned about complexity theory from a Nobel laureate in physics, Murray Gell-Mann. I learned to hunt mushrooms from a naturalist, Bill Isaac. My ex-wife is Hopi, and she is a weaver, and I learned about dyeing and spinning wool from her. So I have a lot of firsthand knowledge that came from my living in Santa Fe.
You know, Arthur, you are one of this country's most accomplished poets, and you've had a very long career, and your writing is, I think they're right. I forget who said that you are a writer of clarity and compassion. I think that's absolutely true of your writing. Your writing tends to be spare, but it is always so clear, and it's always so grounded, and people consider you to be an Asian American poet. And you are, and yet I've always considered you to be a poet. I don't categorize you in that way. Can you talk about, I as a Latino poet and you as an quote-unquote Asian American poet, how those categories both help to promote your work and how they hurt in promoting your work?
Sure. I'd like to start by saying that it might be helpful to categorize a certain poet as Asian American or Native American or, you know, Latino. But ultimately those labels or those ways of categorizing are limiting. And I think people search for those kinds of labels to get a sense of identity or where the poet is coming from. And certainly I am Chinese American, but I think ultimately to see my work in some kind of category like that is far too limiting. I draw from classical Chinese poetry as a source, but I'm very international. I've been reading all over the world, actually. So I think the categories, and not just in terms of sort of race or ethnicity, but in terms of poetic group, you know, to call someone a beat poet or a language poet or a formalist, they become extremely limiting. And I think ultimately we're all poets. It was Adrienne Rich who said, if you're going to even use the term American poetry, that doesn't work because there are American poetries. There are so many worlds inside of poetry. So I personally would like to shed these labels.
Arthur, I went to one of your poetry readings, in fact, here at UTEP many years ago. And when you read your work, I noticed that you tap your foot like you're keeping beat. Are you aware that you do that? Do you do that deliberately? Do you still do that? Can you talk about that?
The musicality to a poem is really important to me, and the sense of a kind of rhythm and cadence and spell with language. And sometimes I'm counting silences as well as sounds. So I think maybe 15 years ago when you heard me read, I was consciously trying to slow the pace of the language down and to feel it in my body. You know, and poetry is visceral. It's the words are physical. So the tapping or the kind of motion helped me ground the poem and really think of it as, you know, we both studied with Denise Levertov as a kind of dance or kind of use of the body in space, and that kind of tapping helped me choreograph the poem. I think I do it less overtly now, but when I'm reading, I'm still very conscious of that kind of pulse and rhythm behind the language.
And I thought of Denise at the time, and I think of you, of her and you. She always thought of the poem as a score. Her line breaks were like scores. She says, read your score. Always read what you write. And I always felt that when you read your poem, you do read what you've written. Is that just something that you picked up from her or something that is internal to you? Did you always have that gift?
That's a wonderful question, and thank you for asking it. Although I studied with Denise when I was very young, I was actually at MIT when I was first starting to write, and Denise came from Berkeley, which is how I eventually went west, but she taught a combined MIT-Harvard class, and she, as you said, emphatically emphasized the idea of the words on the page as a score, as a notation. Although I heard Denise say that, I think it took me many years to actually make that happen. And I think it evolved over time where as my poems became more dense and more rich and braided different worlds together, I realized that I had to slow the pace of the poem down. I couldn't just read it like a piece of fiction because it was too rich and dense and listeners couldn't really follow it. So I began experimenting with how to put silences and white space into the poem and incorporate that and to allow them as a kind of breathing space and to slow the pace of the language down. So although it was a goal or objective of mine early on, it wasn't until many, many years later that I was actually doing it.
We're talking to Arthur Z, whose latest book is called Ginkgo Light. We'll get to that in a minute, but I wanted to talk about the red shifting web, not just the book, but the poem itself. Perhaps that's what you're most known for. That book has just rocked poets all over the place. But there's a particular line in it that I think describes you perfectly. It's, I am an absorbing form. And this is much different from being an observing form because it's in the body.
Right.
And I love the way that you're able to go from place to place, from image to image, from incident to incident, but you're not doing it just visually. You're not doing it. You're doing it actually as an absorbing form. Is that what a poet is? Is that what you are as a poet, an absorbing form?
I think so, and by that I mean sort of taking in but also transforming. And it seems to me the imagination is not just like a mirror, some people propose, you know, the imagination just throws back. But I think ultimately, you know, if you're a poet, if you're a creative person, you are taking in, but you're also transforming and absorbing. And the other metaphor I like to use is to think of it as food, like all of these things come in to one as nourishment, but they also get transformed. So I like to think of that absorbing form as not just taking in, but that taking in is really the first step toward some kind of transformation and nourishment and feeding of energy.
Oh, that's nice. You know, that explains one of your images in Chrysalis, which opens the Ginkgo light. Naval sonar slices through whales even as a portion of male dorsal fin is served to the captain. Going from one thing to another and connected only by the visceral. And the other thing that you say in Red Shifting Web, which I find is really a beautiful explanation of how you get away with your, you know, going from place to place, is you say near and far, a continuous warp. It's as if there really is no space separating anything. Is this an idea that you develop in your poetry?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this idea of, like, all time is present now in a way, past, present, and future are synchronous or existing simultaneously in a way. And the idea of all places of near and far coexisting, that they're part of one continuum or continuity, those are sort of ideas, but I like to think of them as ideas made physical that have come to me over time. You could say there are Taoist roots to these ideas. The Lao Tzu, the Tao Te Ching, says to travel far is to return. And I love the idea that if you go so far out, you're really circling back to where you started.
It sounds like physics, too.
Right, absolutely.
Well, it's really interesting because when I read your work, I experience the work of a philosopher. I really believe that poetry is the way that you do philosophy. And I like the way that you bring ideas. And as William Carlos Williams says, that there are no ideas but in things. And you incarnate those ideas in such concrete ways. But you're also a very quiet poet. You know, we live in such a frantic world. And yet when you speak in your poetry, the way that you speak, you're quiet. Your voice invites us to meditate on whatever it is that you're trying to examine. You're always examining landscape, but mostly you examine ideas, and I think those ideas are quite contemporary, and yet you don't do it in a contemporary way, which I think is very interesting to me. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best speaker about this, because obviously, you know, I can't stand outside of myself. One of the things I'm interested in doing is, and I suppose you could say it has political overtones, is because our world is so chaotic and we live in such a fast-paced, you know, superficial, consumer-oriented world, one of the things I'm conscious of poetry accomplishing is to try and slow things down, but to really get a reader to situate in the moment and to be physically rooted there, and that if we can do that, it's enriching our lives and it's deepening our experience of the world. So when my voice is quiet, I'm oftentimes trying to notice or get a reader to notice very subtle or simple things, but that are also very profound and ultimately very important, because if we're in a hurry, we just slip right on by. We don't pay attention to those things. But I'm trying to sort of shift or open up the whole consciousness, and hopefully there's emotional undercurrents as well, that as these ideas get explored, there are all sorts of surprises and discoveries along the way. And there's a kind of undercurrent of emotionality that comes forward too, which is also part of this grounding and stillness.
We're talking to Arthur C. I want to get back to the physics, if I can, because it's a subject that I'm kind of interested in. But there's a marriage, a very, you know, recent popular marriage of quantum mechanics and Eastern mysticism. Do you find that to be a combining both ways of seeing reality, a way of deepening the way you see?
I do, and I would throw in the pre-Socratic philosophers into the mix. I love Heraclitus, whom I consider a poet more than a philosopher, but sometimes I'm just amazed at what he accomplishes in a sentence. It's like, wow, where did that come from? And it's a worldview, but it's also extremely poetic. You know, the cliche is, you know, you cannot step twice into the same river, but there are other Heraclitus fragments that are just astonishing. I see these worlds as reinforcing each other. I don't think one needs to prioritize or choose one over the other. But I like how when you talk to really good physicists, ultimately they realize they know so little about the world, and there's the kind of mysticism that takes over.
Right.
And people thought the nucleus was sort of the center of the atom, and then it turns out there are protons, and then inside of protons there are like quarks, and what if the quarks get split apart? It becomes this endlessly fascinating cosmology and view of the whole world, and the really good scientists become very humble and realize we know so little about the ultimate, you know, state of things. And that kind of humility, I think, and insight is where sort of art and science come together.
And I think that's what I really admire about your work, that it's humble. And even though I think it challenges, and there's really a lot of, I would consider a lot of your work political poetry that really is in a serious dialogue with the world that we live in, I find it interesting that there is so little anger in your work. And I admire that, because the world I live in makes me angry, and it doesn't seem to make you angry. You seem to be able to step into a space to really just want to dialogue with that difficult and complicated world.
You know, I've written about like the riot at the New Mexico State Penitentiary, and that could be a poem just about pure anger, but I think I want to have a compassionate view of things too. So in many ways that releases the anger, or you know, I like to think of the phrase from Shakespeare, we are all frail.
Yes,
so
we are.
Like, who am I to be, you know, judging? Or yes, I can be angry, but also there's a sense of wanting to let go or try and assimilate into the larger scheme of things. But at the same time, I am very much in sort of tension or in dialogue with things happening in the world.
Can you talk about how your work has changed over the years? You've been writing for how long?
As long as you've been in Santa Fe?
For 40, I don't know, 2 years maybe. My early work was much more a kind of lyrical narrative, which was influenced by classical Chinese poetry. And that's a continuous thread, I would say, the idea of clarity. I love the clarity of the ancient Chinese poems when Li Bo says, peach blossoms drop into flowing water. I mean, I love that clarity. That's written in 720 Common Era, and here it is in 2012. And part of the magic of why it can be so immediate is that clarity, focus, and primacy of the image. And so those are continuous, but in the evolution of my work. But I think I got to a point where the short poem became claustrophobic for me. When I was in college, I always remember the professor talking about the poem as this well-wrought urn, this artifact. And I got to the stage where I needed to shatter it. I needed to break it apart. The poem wasn't an artifact for me. Or if I thought of the poem as an artifact, it wasn't satisfying to me any longer. You know, to try and copy the Tang Dynasty poet seemed ludicrous. And I needed to find my own voice, and I needed to muddy things up and to find the sort of dirty as well as the beautiful, and to, you know, put more of the world into the poem. And so that meant breaking apart the sort of poem that looks really beautiful on the page. And so over time, like in Archipelago, there are lots of fragments. There are the ideas that there are these islands and they're all connected below surface. So there are very jagged areas and then they're very lyrical areas. So my work has got more complex over time, but I would say I'm interested in a really short poem, but I'm also interested in what a series or sequence or suite of poems can accomplish. And I've just completed a new manuscript called Compass Rose, which Michael Wiegers has accepted for 2014 for Copper Canyon Press. And a lot of it has to do with directionality and traveling through the world and finding or searching for some kind of grounding or a place that one can really stand on. So my work has evolved in terms of complexity. It's incorporated a lot more levels of diction. It's used a lot more wider structures. It's put more of the world into it. And in some ways, I guess I want to say that I still value what that short poem can do, but I don't have an image of it as a kind of image of perfection that I had in my 20s. And certainly the Chinese poems that I aspire to were fine for their time, but they're no longer satisfying for me.
I guess I hear you saying that you used to believe that poetry was a distillation and that you wanted to distill it, to write to the center of the meaning of things.
Yes.
And that you no longer believe that that's what poetry does, is just distill.
Yes. I think I got to this feeling that that was a very limited view, that that was somehow beautiful, but hermetic in a way and sealed off from the world. And I love the image of the humility of Navajo weavers who, when they're about to complete a weaving, they lay in an imperfection near the end. And I love the idea that there's like a flaw or a fragment or there's something that enters the poem that truly makes it alive. And that flaw, that imperfection, is something that's missing in that earlier idea of a distillation.
We've been talking to Arthur Zee, the first poet laureate of Santa Fe, here on Words on a Wire. It's such a pleasure talking to you, Arthur. We could have this conversation forever. Tell me about who are some of your favorite poets and the poets that you learned most from?
They're from different time periods and different cultures. And again, early on, they were the great Tang poets, Li Bai, Du Fu, Wang Wei. I think Pablo Neruda was really important to me, particularly the very dark Residencia poems, which were very sort of surreal, but had such a kind of brooding and powerful energy behind the language. I taught myself enough Spanish, and I took a class in Spanish at the College of Santa Fe just to be able to read Neruda.
That's a good reason.
because I just felt so engaged with the power of his poetry. When I first read Walt Whitman, I was like, oh, what's the big deal? But now, I mean, I love Whitman. And I think the early poems, when I was young, the poems of Whitman that I read were some of his worst ones, the ones that get taught in public school, you know, Oh, Captain, My Captain. And it took me many years to sort of get through a lot of what I thought of as the melodrama or whatever to see, wow, this is really a quintessential American poet and a really great one. And so I have been reading a lot of Whitman and Dickinson, and certainly Stevens is important to me.
Yeah, well, I would expect that you would be a fan of Dickinson from reading your work. Can you tell me about Dickinson in relationship to your own work?
Sure. Her compression is just startling, and also her kind of imaginative innovation, how certain phrases, and they're just mysterious, but the way they come out and strike with such force is something that's astonished me again and again. And also, I've been interested in the idea that her poems are these fascicles, or these loose sequences, that they may often be read out of order, but one particular poem might seem like a kind of jam or just powerful 20-line poem, but it's actually part of a larger, looser orchestration, and that has really influenced me in terms of developing my sequences, where I'm not just telling a narrative where this happened and then that happened, but it's almost more like magnetism. I'm putting this poem and then juxtaposing another poem and creating a kind of field of energy. And when I read Dickinson's fascicles, the way these strings of poems were put together, it makes me feel that. I'm not searching for some kind of big statement at the end, but I'm fascinated by the idea of what made her choose these 10 or 12 poems and string them together. Clearly, she saw some kind of energy connecting them. So she's been an endless source of inspiration.
And she's interesting, too, for she's a model for American poets, I think, for this reason, and that is that she is sometimes absolutely clear. The meaning of what she's trying to say is absolutely clear, and other times she is absolutely impenetrable.
I agree.
And it's like, what? And you can't parse it out. You can't figure it out. It's a puzzle. And yet other poems are not puzzles at all. They just stare you down with their clarity and with their fierceness and with a kind of profundity that other poets can never arrive at.
I agree.
It's really interesting because I don't look at your poetry as puzzles, but sometimes they do puzzle me. Sometimes I have to figure it out. And yet, when I arrive at their meeting, when I arrive at the end of it, I say, oh, I get it. Arthur, we do a segment called Poem of the Week. Could you pick a poem and read it to us for this week's segment?
Yes. I'm going to read a poem called Crisscross, and it braids two worlds, just as a preface. And one world is situated here in northern New Mexico, and the other world is been in Europe and read at Poetry International in Rotterdam. So there are images from Europe coming in, but the two get braided together, and it's part of the crisscross. Crisscross. Meandering across a field with wild asparagus, I write with my body the characters for grass, water, transformation, ache, to be one with spring. Biting into watermelon, spitting black seeds onto a plate, I watch the eyes of an Armenian accordion player, and before dropping a few euros into his brown cap, smell sweat and fear. I stay wary of the red horse Rolampago, latch the gate behind me. A thorned Russian olive branch arcs across the path below my forehead. And approaching the Powaki River, I recall the sign, beware pickpockets. Find backhoe tracks, water diverted into a ditch. Crisscrossing the stream, I catch a lightning flash, the white-capped Chuchis peaks behind to the east. And in the interval between lightning and thunder, as snow accumulates on black branches, the chasm between what I envision and what I do.
That was Arthur Z reading a poem, Crisscross. I have to tell you, you're one of the poets that I constantly go back to because you're always teaching me something new, and I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
And we've been talking to Arthur Z, one of America's premier poets, and we're happy to have him on our show today on Words on a Wire.